What I'm going to, I said this to you, I think, if not this time around, then a year and a half ago, that I do spend most of my time in the first century and not in the 20th, or then it was already the 21st. And today I'm going to do something a little, well, I don't want to say dangerous. I'm going to try to bring you back with me to the first century or third century. And if we're talking about education, I want to visit a school, what you would call in Eastern Europe in the 19th century a cheder. But I want to give you a sense of what it was like going to school in the first or second or third century. And the argument, my argument, is very simply, were it not for what we're going to see in the next few minutes, we would not be here today doing what we're doing. This idea of education, the continuity of Jewish education, is really what I'm interested in. And whereas I'm a historian, what I want to do is play the past off on the present and see what we might learn from the past, but really to get a sense of what it was like in the past. Now, I have a problem. We do not have historical literature, descriptive literature, that was written as history for the first, let's say, 5-6 centuries of the Common Era. In other words, there's nobody like a Josephus Flavius or you know, a Thucydides or a Herodotus writing a description of what Judaism was like in the first centuries of the Common Era. Josephus was interested, you should know, mostly in politics, and he doesn't live anymore. By the time I get to my period, the second, third, fourth centuries, he's not around anymore. And even if he were around, he would not describe what a school looked like. We have the literature of the rabbis, but the rabbis are not historians. They're teaching law, they're teaching morals, ethical statements. But the trick in my trade is to take materials that were not written for history, that were written for totally different reasons, and to try and extract historical reality from them. And we can do it with the issue of education in a very fascinating way. Let me give you an example. Jewish culture and memory likes to play with the idea not only that Jews always study, but that it's never too late to begin. The late bloomer. You are never, and I know this may resonate here, you are never too old to start. By the way, I always like to juxtapose that idea with another idea that's very common in Jewish history, because Jews like to tell the opposite story, and that is the young geniuses. You know, the fellow who was 3 or 4 and 5 years old and knew all of Talmud by heart. And it's very interesting. I always ask myself, what societies play up the idea of the person who didn't know what an aleph bet looked like until he was 40 years old? And what societies like to play up the idea of the child who's 5, 6 years old and knows everything, you know, backwards and forwards? And I find that there are different stages of history that play up one against the other. If you want to read an example of the child prodigy, there's a well-known professor of Talmud who teaches at Columbia University, David Weiss Halivni, who wrote a fascinating autobiography of himself. He was literally a Holocaust remnant, and he describes how he was tested on Talmud by the rabbis of his local community when he was less than 10 years old, right, and had to know whole pages by heart, and he describes very graphically, so he's the other side. But the Talmud was fascinated by the possibility that the greatest rabbis might have been totally illiterate until they reached an advanced age. And the most fascinating example is probably the greatest rabbi of all, Akiva. Now, why does he interest me? Because the rabbis are going to describe how Akiva came to learn for the first time in his life. What do they do? And this is what is so beautifully dramatic in the literature. They will take Akiva and they will say, well, for him to have learned how to read when he was already 40 years old, we will have to transport him and insert him into a cheder reality, because he's going to have to go through all the stages that a 5-year-old would have to go through, only he's doing it 40 years later. So when they describe how Akiva learned alephbet, what are they going to do? They're going to use the imagery that they know from how children learn Aleph Bet. They're going to apply it, and they're going to literally bring Akiva into the schoolroom. Now, when I read, and this is, if you look at your handout, this is the first story that you have. And it begins like this. What were Rabbi Akiva's beginnings? It is said, he was 40 years old and had not studied a thing. He, Akiva, went together with his son and they appeared before an elementary teacher, school teacher. Now, imagine this. He probably enters, and there's Akiva, and then here are all the little five-year-olds near him. And they're going to probably have to all sit. Now, they're going to probably sit. If you ever picked up your kids or grandchildren from kindergarten, you all sat on these little stools, right? So there's Akiva sitting on one of these tiny little stools with his son. And that they're going to tell us how he learned. Now, what I like about this is real literature. Imagine putting this on stage. All of us know who Akiva is. We know that he will evolve and become the great sage, and yet we find him going through the motions of a child. And so what happens? They come before the elementary teacher, who's called in Hebrew Melamed Tinokot. He said, Master, teach me Torah. Now this is already something very interesting. As opposed, and I'm going to make constant comparisons with the Greco-Roman world of the period. The Greeks and the Romans had a curriculum that was intended to fulfill two goals. One was to create a learned gentleman. You had to know a series of literary works, beginning with Homer, and then going through the curriculum. The Greeks called this paideia, right? From where we have paideia, right? And that rendered you cultured. That rendered you part of the intellectual milieu that your parents wanted to insert you. But it was also career-oriented. The Greeks and Romans taught their children, or at least their sons, we'll talk about women in a little while, 2 minutes on about women later on, and this is not to offend anyone, but obviously we're talking about a patriarchal society at the time. But I can prove to you that Jewish girls did go to school, and I can prove that they knew how to read as well as boys sometimes, and we have information on this as well. Nevertheless, the Greeks then thought about creating a cultured gentleman and someone who could follow up a career, usually as an orator, as a lawyer, someone who has to have access to these materials. Jews had a totally different curriculum. You go to school to learn Torah. You go to school to become a good Jew, right? There are no other books to learn. There's no secular literature at the time. The literature is sacred literature. And so he goes and he doesn't say, teach me to read. He says, teach me Torah. But of course, before you can study Torah, you have to learn how to read because you're going to have to read the text. Now comes an interesting line. Rabbi Akiva took hold of one end of the tablet and his son the other end of the tablet. What is this tablet? We know exactly what this is. Huh?
Ten Commandments.
No? Ah, he knows. Howard knows. Right, very good. Let me explain. Exactly. The Greeks and Romans taught writing using a tablet. Now, the tablet would be, and it's called in Hebrew, we would call it luach, right? A tablet. What they did is either they poured wax on the tablet, then the teacher would write the letters of the alphabet. The student would copy the letters. Once you knew the letters, the teacher would test the child if he knows the names of the letters, the forms of the letters, and the sounds that the letters make. Once you know that, you would start writing syllables, bar, gar, dar, that is to say, beta, alpha, rho, gamma, alpha, rho, the way I learned Hebrew and Yiddish when I was a kid, right? Komets, alif, or komets, vet, bo, right? And so they would do that. Once they knew how to pronounce syllables, the teacher would write on the tablet an aphorism, a short line of a couple of words that, words of wisdom, pearls of wisdom, and the child would copy them. We have discovered throughout the Greco-Roman world, we have these tablets. I could take you to museums and show you these tablets. And some of them are very funny. First of all, the aphorisms weren't always the most pleasant. You know, study well lest they beat you, right? Or, you know, put your trust in no man, or something. Those terrible lines, right? And the child would copy them. And by the way, invariably what happens is the child is just learning how to write. So he begins, you know, and he's writing it one line after another. It's, if you have seen Bart Simpson, right? right? You know, copying the lines. And usually he'll get about halfway and suddenly realizes, oops, I don't have enough room, right? So the letters get smaller and smaller, and then they start going down the side. Sometimes the teacher writes the aphorism with a mistake on top, and the child slavishly copies the mistake, right, on the tablet. So we're going to see, though, we have very precise information about how this was done, and I'm going to show you in a second. So this is the tablet. In other words, when the rabbis describe how Akiva goes to school, what are they doing? They are inserting him into the learning reality of the day, right? And what I like about the rabbis is they're basically saying, we learn just the way the Greeks and Romans learn. In other words, they're not claiming to have a superior system, right? They have the same system. And as I say, these tablets are to be found everywhere. Sometimes, by the way, they didn't use wax. They would use a wooden tablet. They would carve the letters into the wooden tablet, and the child would have to, he would take a stylus, and he would kind of follow the path. The teacher at first would go like this with him, and then the child would have to do the writing himself. Now, what does it say here? Rabbi Akiva took hold of one end of the tablet, his son the other end of the tablet. He, the teacher, wrote down Aleph Bet, the first two letters of the alphabet. And he learned it. He, meaning Akiva, learned it. Then the teacher would do, and we know this from archaeology, the teacher would change the order. He would write down, instead of Aleph Bet, he would write Aleph Tav, the first letter and the last letter. Then he would write the second letter, Bet, and the next to last letter, Shin, At Bash, it would be called. In other words, first, last, second, next to last. And what is interesting is, so every child would know immediately, because you would remember this by heart, what is the second letter? What is the next to last letter? And as a result, you'll find something very interesting, that in rabbinic exegesis of the Bible, they sometimes apply the system of at bash, first, last, as codes. In other words, they will explain words where the last letter takes the place of the first letter, the next to last takes the place of the next of the second letter, and they figure out all sorts of words this way. I don't want to get into too technical. For instance, the word for Babylonia in Hebrew is Bavel. Bavel is written Bet, Bet, Lamed, right? Bet is the second letter, Bet is the second letter, and Lamed is the, I don't know, 12th or something, right? There's a name of a country that appears in the Bible, and it is called Sheshach, Shin, Shin, Kaf. Shin is the next to last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So what does the rabbi say? Sheshach must be Bavel, because Shin is the equivalent of Bet, Shin the equivalent of Bet, Lamed the equivalent of Kaf. And so they're playing with this. So he switches the order. And by the way, we have this throughout the Greek world on shards as well. Sometimes they would actually play with these letters. And you know, this was the big hurdle, learning what letters look like, identifying their names. We have Greek stories where a rich Greek, once hired 24 slaves, and each slave had to be one letter, right? And the child would have to recognize the names of the letters based on the slaves. Then he would tell the slaves to stand in a different order, right? And it was all of this stuff very kind of strange. Now, after he learns Aleph Taf, the assumption being he knows how to read, he then goes on to learn Torah. And what is the first book of the Bible that he learns? Very, very strange. Torat Kohanim, Leviticus. And this has raised questions from day one. That's what you're going to teach a young child at 5 years old? That's the first thing? How to take an animal, slaughter it, burn it on an altar, see the blood flowing down the altar. Is there nothing better? But let me ask you, where would you begin with a child? Where did some of you begin when you studied Bible for the first time? So here she says immediately, Genesis. Oh, yeah, teach them the easy stuff, like creation, right? Any child can understand creation, right? So then they tell you, no, skip over creation, right? Oh, No. Go with Genesis, but after the creation story. Yeah, get to the stories of Noah and his daughters, and or Abel and or Cain and Abel killing. So you either have sex or murder. You know, take your choice, right? You wind up skipping around, right? So I don't know. And then there's lots of scholarship why they started with Leviticus. One simple reason might be that in the ancient world, very often, who were the people who did have access to learning? They might have been the priests, right? And priests, obviously Leviticus is their book, so it could be that this is some sort of a status symbol of studying Leviticus first. And thus he proceeded until he learned all the Torah, meaning the books of the Bible, and then he goes on to Mishnah. So what do you have here? You have Akiva, the late bloomer, who goes through all the motions of a child. Now, secretly, I'll lower my voice. Do I think that this really happened with Akiva? I don't know. But the storyteller is giving me solid information. The storyteller is imposing on Akiva the reality that he, the storyteller, knows to make it a believable story. So I can use this story, and we'll see this in a minute, to get a sense of what the school was like. Now, who else might be a late bloomer? Whom else could we consider to be someone who did not come to Jewish education as a youth? Is a convert. So the same thing happens with converts. The convert stories also, these are people who are grown-ups, who come to study, they've converted. They too have to be taught Aleph Bet, and you have the same stories. So look at source number two. A Gentile came to Hillel and said, "Master, convert me." At first he wrote for him Aleph Bet and taught him, etc. But if you look in the continuation of this text, he came before Hillel, and it's interesting. He asks Hillel, how many Torahs are there? And Hillel says, well, there's a written Torah and there's an oral Torah. And he says, I don't believe you about this oral Torah, but teach me the written one first. So what does he do? He writes, on the first day he pronounced Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. On the morrow, Hillel reversed the order. He, the convert, said to him, but yesterday did you not recite it in the other order? He replied, you must rely upon me. Rely upon me regarding the oral Torah as well. In other words, I am your access to, I am your entry to Judaism. In other words, you rely on me. If you want to become Jewish, somebody's going to have to teach you, accept all of this tradition. The rabbis did something beautiful with this story of tablets. This is one of my favorite examples of what you can do with Agadah. Look at source number three, tablets. The word is luchot, luach. And this is an exegesis to the book of Exodus 31. When he had finished speaking with Moses on the mountain of Sinai, he gave him, meaning Moses, two tablets of testimony, luchot ha'edut, right? Tablets of stone inscribed by the fingers of God. And the rabbis ask, tablets, why were tablets given to Israel at Sinai? And what is their answer? You find that when a child enters the schoolhouse, at first they recite for him from a tablet, then he reads from a scroll. So with Israel, first they were given tablets of testimony and then a Torah. This is beautiful because I don't know if you caught the point here. What does this mean? That what happens every day at the schoolhouse when the child appears for the first time is what? Is a reenactment of what?
Sinai.
Of Sinai. In other words, the schoolhouse becomes a new vision, as it were, a new appearance of standing at Sinai. At Sinai, you receive tablets. Here you receive tablets, which I think is a beautiful idea. Raising, and this is a constant factor. Think about the implications of this for Jewish history. A schoolhouse assumes the sanctity I very often begin lectures with a pronouncement reminding people to turn their cell phones back on after the lecture. Which I always thought was a polite way of saying it. Right. But I think that this idea of turning the schoolhouse into a Sinai, in other words, sanctifying the schoolhouse. But now comes something even better. How did they learn the Aleph Bet? And we have a source here for which I'm going to need a little space. We have in our possession a primer of how the children studied alphabet, how they were taught the look of the letters, the physical shape of the letters. And it's very reminiscent of what we read in Roman literature. There was a Roman in the first century called Quintilianus, who wrote a book on oratoria, on how you teach oratory. And in that book, he says something very interesting. When you teach a child, don't teach him technically, but insert into that teaching, even when you're teaching him the most mundane stuff, the physical appearance of a letter, teach some ethical teaching that accompanies it. And the rabbis pick up on that, or maybe they, for all I know, they invented it. Look at source number 4. The rabbis told Rabbi Joshua ben Levi, children now come to school and say things the like of which had not been taught even in the days of Joshua ben Nun. In other words, our children today know stuff that even in the time of the Bible they didn't know. And here I have to insert a little bit of information. When did all this begin? How far back is there a Jewish school system? And the rabbis are going to do something very rare for themselves, and I didn't put it on the source sheet, and I should have. Usually you suspect the rabbis will be very proud, too proud to admit that there was a time when things weren't working so well. Sure enough, in the Talmud, they actually say this, that throughout what we call the post-biblical period, the Second Temple period, we did not have a good functioning school system, they say. We tried this, we tried that. We tried opening up schools, one story has it, where we thought the best ideal age for bringing a child to learn is 16 or 17 years old. We don't even know if they had the word adolescence in their vocabulary yet, or puberty, or in other words, I mean, that's the worst possible age you can imagine. You know, all of the juice is flowing, and you're telling this kid, sit here now for 5 hours and listen to me, right? So what did they describe? They would bring them at the age of 15, 16, and the kid would start kicking his teacher and running out, right? So then they decide, well, we'll bring children to Jerusalem, but who can afford to bring his kid to Jerusalem? Until a rabbi of the very, very end of the Second Temple period, his name is Joshua ben Gamla, sets up a school system. Now, why do I like that source? Because the rabbis are willing to admit it took us a long time to get our act together. And they finally managed to put some sort of a system together that we're going to discuss now. And one of the things they get together is how to teach the alphabet. And here you'll have something interesting. This is what they were taught. Aleph, Bet, Aleph, Bina, learn wisdom. Gimel, Dalid, Gimel, Dalim. Now, let me explain what this is all about. Every letter comes to represent a word. When you put the words together, they spell out a message. And now let me explain this example. Aleph, Bet, the first two letters, it means Aleph. Now, you know the word ulpan. What does the word ulpan mean? The word means to go to learn, a place of learning. That's what the word means. You use it now for learning Hebrew, right? But it really means, ulpan means to learn. So aleph bet, aleph b bina, teach wisdom. Gimel dalid, now comes the nice part. Gimel dalid, gimol dalim, give charity to the poor. And now the Talmud asks, I got to act this out now. I usually do this on the blackboard, but we don't have a blackboard, and so I have no choice but to be a gimel and a dalit. So gimel dalit, give charity, gimel dalim, give charity to the poor. This is a gimel. Use your imagination here a little now. And so I'm a gimel. The dalit is standing over there. Dalit, the word dal in Hebrew means what? Poor. And I'm the gomel, I'm the good guy, right? So the Talmud says, why is the leg of the gimel stretched forward towards the dalit? Because the gimel is the one giving charity, and he should be running after the dal to get to him to give him charity. Okay, that's the gimel. Now I am a dalit. Okay? Can you all see me? Now, why, if the gimel is over there, and I'm the dalit, The Talmud asks, why is the Dalit looking that way and not that way at the Gimel, who's giving him money? Ah, because he's embarrassed to look at the person who's giving him money. He can't look back at him. But then the Talmud says, if that's the case, why is his leg spread backwards towards the Gimel? Because he doesn't want to get too far away from him. Right. That's a beautiful story, right? You tell that to a child, he's going to remember what a Gimel and a Dalit look like. Then they got to a problem. They got to the letter He and Vav. But you know, those are the letters that spell God's name. He, Vav, Yud, He, Vav. So, He, Vav, we can't do anything. Zeh Shmo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's God's name. Let's skip over that. But if you give money to the poor, Zayin, Chet, Tet, Yud, Kaf, Lamed. Those are the next letters. If you give money to the poor, God, Zan Otcha, the word Mazon, like Birkata Mazon means, God will feed you. Ve'chan otcha, chen in Hebrew means charm. God gives you grace, gives you charm. U'me'tet, now comes tet, me'tiv lecha, tet. He is beneficial to you. He gives you yud, yerusha. What is the word yerusha? A heritage. He gives you, right, something to, an inheritance, right? Right, and so on. They go through the alphabet like this. They play with the physical traits. For instance, kuf resh. I'm skipping around. Kuf kadosh, sacred, the sacred one. Resh, rasha, the evil one. And then they say, why does a kuf look like this? Right? If you have another kuf, kind of has a hook on the top of the letter. Amar hakadosh baruch hu, because the kadosh said, remember who's standing in front of him? The Rei, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I can't look at the Rasha, right? Eini yachol listakel Rasha. So the Kuf has that top folded over, so he's hiding his phrase from the Rasha. You're in the schoolhouse. But of course, what else do you realize here? The child is being taught to recognize letters, but he's also being taught what? Ethical, moral behavior. How to behave. And he's very malleable. He's very pliant. He's 5 years old, and so he's going to remember this. Yes.
This all sounds like it reminds me of the Sefer Yetzirah where they go in and talk.
Later on, the form of letters becomes central, not only in Sefer Yetzirah but throughout Kabbalistic literature. And you know they play with letters later on. The form, the shape of letters become a major issue. Right.
Where everyone was taught with an ethical message.
This is where it comes from. In other words, it goes back, and so we're talking about here, modernity can learn no small lesson from some of these sources. And I'm going to show you some other lessons that I think we can and should maybe learn from this. If I could actually draw up for you, literally, the daily schedule of when a child went to school and when he came back from school. Now, how do we know this? Again, the rabbis are not into history. But in explaining all sorts of biblical stories, they insinuate this. For instance, let me give you an example. And this is example number five. Her rival would taunt her to annoy her. Do you remember the beginning of the book of Samuel? How does the book of Samuel begin? There is a man called Elkanah. And he has two wives, Hannah and Penina. Penina has children. Hannah is barren. And the Bible says that Penina would taunt her. How would she taunt her? Every morning at such and such hour, Penina would say to Hannah, oh, aren't you preparing your children to go to school this morning? Oh, I forgot you don't have any children. And real nasty, right?
Yeah, no, indeed.
Right? And at such and such hour of midday, Penina would come to Hannah and say, aren't you going to pick up your children from school now?
Oh.
Again, I keep on forgetting, right? But what do I, the historian, learn? at what hour of the day, supposedly, did Penina go to Hannah and say this? So I, the historian, realized that the storyteller assumes that that's the hour that kids came home from school. And that's what we have here. So her rival would taunt her. Penina would rise early and say to Hannah, "Are you not rising to wash the faces of your children so that they may go to school?" And at 6 hours, she would say, "Are you not preparing to receive your children who are coming from the schoolhouse?" Now, what is 6 hours? The Jews of antiquity divided the day into 12 hours of daylight. In other words, they counted hours from sunrise to sunset, and then they divided it into 12, which, by the way, means that an hour wasn't always a uniform unit. It depends on what season. In other words, in the winter, an hour would be shorter. In the summer, an hour would be longer, right? But at 6 hours, which means somewhere around midday, the mother would prepare herself to go off to the schoolhouse to pick the child up, which means children probably study till the hour of, let's say, 1 o'clock or something like that. These are young children, right? Remember? And so they're going through half a day. But remember, it says that they got up very early to go to school and they studied until a certain hour. We even know when they had mini vacations. And there were, now this is interesting. They never had a full vacation. They studied 12 months a year. However, there was a season when they shortened the day, the school day. That's source number 6. Rabbi Yochanan enjoined elementary and Mishnah teachers. This is part of the general text that I want, not to use a strap on children on those days. And I'll explain what that means, those days. Rabbi Samuel Bar Nachmani enjoined elementary and Mishnah teachers to dismiss the children at 4 hours on those days. There were certain days of the year when a child would be sent home after 4 hours rather than 6 hours. Who can guess what days of the year are we talking about? No, so they said Friday, no. Chol HaMoed, no. What days? Very interesting. What days would they send a child home a little earlier? You know, holidays I think they spent at home. I don't think they went to school on Passover. I'm going to prove to you that on Friday night they did go to the schoolhouse. What did you say?
In the winter.
Summer. I would say summer.
You want to? Do you want to discuss this and then... He's right. Or who said summer?
I did.
You were right. Summer, they send them home earlier. Why? It's too hot. It's too, no, these are not kids working in the fields. These are 5, 6-year-old kids. That's too hot. Now, you have to understand something. It's not just that it's too hot. Put yourself in the rabbinic mind. There are 3 weeks in the middle of the summer that are considered dangerous weeks. Weeks when all sorts of calamities, catastrophes, terrible things might happen. What are those 3 weeks? The 3 weeks from the 17th of Tammuz till the 9th of Av, right? When temples are destroyed, when walls fall down in Jerusalem, when sieges begin, when the Jewish people have learned through history that terrible things happen in these days of summer. Now you realize what's happening here. In a practical sense, they're sending them home simply because it's too hot. I have, and I should have brought it, and I don't. We have the equivalent in Roman literature, where in the summer, the neighbors would scream at the school teacher, "Look, it's the summer. Nothing will happen if you give them a vacation until October." Now, why are the neighbors complaining? Because they're suffering from something else. It's called noise, right? And so the neighbors are looking for any excuse to tell the school teacher, give them a vacation, right? So when the summer comes along, they say the same thing, let them out. Later on, we're going to see that the Jews had an interesting problem. Where was this happening? Where is the schoolhouse? And we'll see that there's a major difference between Babylonia and Palestine on this issue. And this is a major difference between the Jewish world and the Greco-Roman world. This is also part of it. Now, you notice something else. He enjoined, Rabbi Yochanan tells them, not to use the strap on children on those days for the same reason. Right now, when you say strap, I know what you're imagining, but you're too polite to say it. What do you think the strap looked like? You want to? You all imagine something like Zorro, right? Right, where they're whipping this kid and they're stripping off. The rabbis say, if you have to use a strap, use a shoelace. Right, that's a beautiful statement. Right, in other words, wow. What is the point? Yes, we believe in corporal punishment, but we don't really believe in corporal punishment. In other words, a shoelace meaning what? It's yes, you're doing it, but you're not really doing it. And there are a number of statements. We always think, because we know that the Bible, there's this famous line, Chosech shifto sonei beno, he who does not use the staff hates his child. In other words, you love your child so much that you whip him. But the fact is that the rabbis were very reticent about doing this, very reticent. We hear about one teacher, I wish I knew what it meant. It says a teacher who, the word in Hebrew is pasha. What is the word pesha, pasha? He did something wrong with the students and he was dismissed from his office. And our imaginations start roaming. What did this teacher do that we hear sometimes teachers doing with children that they ought not be doing with children, right? I don't know if that's what it means, right? I mean, I don't know if this is taking us into New England or in Boston 2, 3, 10, and 20 years ago, right? But it says that the rabbis dismissed a teacher, a very prominent teacher, because he was misbehaving towards his students. And it could mean corporal punishment. It could mean worse. It could mean a lot worse, right? But so the rabbis are very, very careful about how a teacher behaves. They give advice to teachers what to do if a student nevertheless is not picking it up. Look at source number 7. And you realize why I'm reading these sources with you. What you're going to realize as we get into this is a pedagogic society. This is a society that is constantly asking themselves how we can improve the school system. And if it doesn't work this way, we'll do it that way, right? Rav said to Rabbi Shmuel ben Shilat, who is a teacher that appears in a number of places, before the age of 6, do not accept pupils. From that age, you can accept them and stuff them with Torah like an ox. But he also said to him, when you punish the child with lashing, this is what I said to you before, use a shoelace, the attentive one will read of himself. The unattentive one, put him next to a diligent one. And, you know, we think that we invented this in the early 20th century, right? And you have all of these systems of learning that appear. Now, I am very careful not to be apologetic. I have to tell you this. I wrote a long article on this. If you want, I can email it to Ari and you can distribute it here. In the 20th century, a slew of articles appear suddenly, both in Europe and in the United States, about the history of Jewish education. Why? Most of them were really apologetic. Everything that modern education knows, we and the rabbis and the Talmud knew this 2,000 years ago. And it's very distasteful to read this, right? This, you know, one-upmanship. Right. But why suddenly all of these articles? There were two interesting reasons. In Europe, in the 20th century, this really begins the tail end of the 19th, but in the 20th century, as the general in educational system finally comes to the Jews who have broken out of the shtetl and have become part of the modern world, and they begin to develop all sorts of teachers' seminars. And I just spoke to some of you today who said that their father or parents went to these teacher seminars in Vilna and in Warsaw and in many, many cities, both in Lithuania and Poland. As these new modern, not without quotation marks, teacher, Jewish, Hebrew teacher seminars begin to appear, all sorts of teachers there say, you know what, let's go back to the sources and see how they did it then. Maybe we can learn something. But there was another reason. Young Jewish men begin to make it to the United States. They want to start a career. Some of them are looking for an academic career. To put things in a nutshell, they need a quick doctorate. there were no Jewish study departments in universities in the United States in the early 20th century. So they would go to general departments and offer to do a doctorate in their field of expertise. In other words, they would go to departments of education and say, why don't I write a doctorate on Jewish education in antiquity? By the way, lawyers did the same thing, right? All of these Jews who had studied in yeshiva back in Lithuania came to the United States and they went to law departments and they said, why don't I write a doctorate on Jewish law in late antiquity, right? And of course, there was nobody at St. John's University who could read this, right? I say St. John's because that's exactly what my father did, right? when my father came on a visit from Palestine to the United States, and 1939 is when he came on a visit, and the war broke out here, in Europe, and my parents were afraid to travel back to Palestine, so they stayed. So my father goes to St. John's University. He was already a lawyer in Palestine. So he said, why don't I write a doctorate on Jewish law? And they said, that's wonderful, but we have nobody who can read it, right? You know. So they sent out to JTS or to some place to read it. So suddenly you have a whole slew of these doctorates on Jewish education from people who needed quickies. They needed a quick degree, right? Some of them are pure apologetics. Some of them already became more and more interesting. But here you have a classic example of attaching a poorer meaning, a slower student to a diligent student, so that, you know, this idea of chevruta, right, of having them study together. Where was this taking place? And here, well, I'll go to source number 8, although I really should skip further on to another issue. In the Greco-Roman world, who hired the teacher? The parent. If you did not have an interested father, you would never get an education. There, and now I'm going to make a very definitive statement. There was no such thing as public education, the way we understand it, in the ancient Greco-Roman world. Fathers hired the teacher. Very often, the earliest teacher was a slave. The word pedagogue, do you know what it means? Today it means teacher. Where does the word come from? Exactly. Pais is a child, and agen is to walk with the child. The slave who used to walk with the child to the teacher was called the pedagogue, right? But since he led him to education, so it received the secondary meaning, pedagogue is one who leads a child to education. But he simply brought him to the house of the school teacher. By the way, sometimes he carried him to the house of the school teacher. The kid would be a brat, and he would make the slave go through hell on the way, and all sorts of other things. This is interesting. But in the ancient world, that's the way it was done among the Greeks and Romans. And the rabbis come to the realization, this is dangerous. Because what are we striving for? Universal Jewish education. You cannot rely on parents. As much as you would like to rely on parents, you can't. For obvious reasons. There are parents who, some don't have the money, the resources. Some don't realize how important it is. And so you'd like to believe that every parent would want an education, but there probably are a lot of fathers out there that would rather have the child working in the fields with him or minding the store. So what does he have to know how to read? That's my point, right? Yeah. So what do they do? What do? They come up with a fantastic idea, and this is unique, where the community will be responsible for hiring the teacher. This does not happen in the Eastern Jewish world, in Babylonia, but it happens in the land of Israel, where the idea begins to emerge, the local community must hire a school teacher and pay for his salary out of local taxes. This is revolutionary in antiquity.
When was that?
This appears already in the 3rd, 4th, 5th century in our sources. Skip, for instance, to page 2, Source 11. We're going to get back to those that I skipped. Look at source number 11. It was taught, if a person resided in a town 30 days, he is like the townsmen regarding the requirement to pay into the charity fund. If you join a new city After 30 days, you already have to participate in the local charity fund. To contribute clothing after 6 months. After you live in a town for 6 months, you have to give into a fund for clothing for the poor. Municipal taxes after 1 year. To which the Talmud, Palestinian Talmud, asks, what are municipal taxes? These are the salaries of teachers of Bible and Mishnah. In other words, the municipal tax in a local Jewish town goes, among other things, to the salary of the school teacher. And this explains all sorts of interesting things. Look at source number 10. It is a scripture in Jeremiah. I will punish all who oppress them. The prophet says, anyone who oppresses the Jewish people, I will punish them. Come the rabbis and say, there is one exception. For one thing, you are allowed to oppress Jewish people. What is that? Which means even collectors of public charity may not oppress. In other words, the gabai. The word gabai in their Hebrew means gabai tzedakah, one who collects charity. Who is the exception who is allowed to oppress the community, except in the case of salaries of teachers of Bible and Mishnah? There you can squeeze each person as much as possible. Sounds kind of modern, huh? Right? You can oppress them as much as possible. Why? For the teachers, only receive compensation for interrupted labor. What does that mean? This is an interesting phrase. What is the teacher teaching my child? Torah, right? What is the value of Torah? Can you translate the value of Torah in dollars? It's what? It's beyond any price. More than that. Can I demand a salary for teaching Torah? God gave it to us. God gave it to Moses gratis, for free. And according to the rabbis, he tells Moses, just as I gave it to you for free, you've got to pass it on for free. How can a teacher get a salary? He's teaching something that it's a mitzvah to teach. You can't take money for this. So what do you pay the teacher? For time wasted. Right? He could be doing something productive. He could be digging ditches and I don't know what. Right? Instead, he's wasting his time teaching. Right?
Rabbinical contract is being used right now.
Of course. The idea being, now the phrase in Hebrew is a horrible, horrible phrase. The phrase in Hebrew is, you pay him schar batala. So he becomes a batlan, right? He becomes, a batlan means one who's wasting his time, right? Now it's not that he's wasting his time. It means that he's using this time, right, for something for which he could be earning another salary. And so you have to compensate him. And what you're teaching him, but remuneration for even one word of Torah, no human being could pay that reward. If I were paying him what? Based on the value of what he is giving the child, well, that's above any value. You can't put a price on it. So how can you pay the salary that would be commensurate to the worth of the of what it is that he's passing on? Now you have to understand why are they repeating this all so much. There's a very good reason for this. And here I have to let you in on something. What was the social status of school teachers in antiquity? You won't believe this. But it was... they said wonderful things about them. The social status of a regular school teacher was lousy. In the Greco-Roman world and in the Jewish world. We found, you think, oh, learning is wonderful. Why? Because you had the teacher over a barrel. The father, and we have this in literature, the father knew, if you don't want to be my teacher at the price I'm suggesting, I'll go to him. There are a lot of people out there that are unemployed. And this was something, the idea, if he's teaching. In fact, there is a beautiful fragment that we found, right, where somebody from the third century, where somebody asks his friend, have you seen so-and-so lately? This is in Greek. And his friend answers, no, he must be dead or teaching somewhere. Which is wonderful, right? In other words, One second. Let me give you another example. One second. Another example. We have a Greek playwright of the 3rd century, Menippus is his name, who wrote a play on Hades. The champion, the hero of the play, visits Hades, the underworld, as it were, and he describes what he saw there. And the whole thrust of the play is that the Hades is a topsy-turvy world, that everything there is the exact opposite of what it is in this world. So the greater you were in this world, the lower your status in the next world. And this tourist in the play says he saw Philip, the father of Alexander the Great, sitting in some corner, miserable. He says, and we found people like Philip, the father of Alexander the Great, sitting in a corner, and what are they doing? They're selling herring and teaching alpha beta. In other words, that's as low as you could go, right? Is to sell herring. Now, I don't know if they're preparing for Kiddush or what, right? But they're selling, it says salted fish, right? They're preparing selling salted fish and teaching alpha beta. In other words, again, this comes through, and it comes through in Jewish sources as well. That school teachers, see, and this is the dichotomy. You wanted to ask a question before, I'm sorry.
Help me with this, but I remember in Vayechi,
yes,
that Jacob, when he was giving the lessons, one of the sons was going to be a poor wanderer, and if he was stayed or was employed, they would be a teacher, going from place to place.
Yes, it doesn't say, no, first of all, it doesn't say it in the blessings. It says it in rabbinic in Rashi, it says it, right? In other words, he takes the Talmud, and I think he applies it not to Zvulun, I don't remember, yes, but to one of the sons. This idea being the itinerant, right, Melamed, right, who's going around. Yeah, because that was the phenomenon, that was the reality. So what do the rabbis say? We can't rely on the beneficence of fathers or of parents to provide the salary for teacher, the community, and this becomes a communal undertaking. Now this, by the way, if you want an example of the status of the teacher, look at source 14. The sage is taught, a person should sell all he owns and marry the daughter of a sage. What you're going to encounter in this source is the totem pole, right? The hierarchy of Jewish society. And it goes down the rungs of the totem pole, and you can already guess who's on the bottom, right? So you should sell all you have and marry the daughter of a sage. If he cannot find the daughter of a sage, let him marry the daughter of one of the leaders of the generation, meaning one of the communal leaders, what we would call the head of a federation or something like that. right. right. The phrase is gedol hador, and that's what it means, really. It means a communal leader, right? If he could not find a daughter of one of the leaders of the generation, let him marry the daughter of the head of a synagogue. The phrase in Greek is archi synagogos. And we find this phrase all over in Jewish inscriptions. The head of the synagogue. It could mean the head of the local community or the head of the synagogue proper. Okay. If he cannot find the daughter of the head of a synagogue, let him marry the daughter of the charity collector. You see what we're doing? We're going down the ladder. Who is the last positive guy on the ladder? If he cannot find the daughter of the charity collector, let him marry the daughter of the school teacher, but let him not marry the daughter of the Am Haaretz. Am Haaretz, the ignoramus, right? So we went down the ladder. The lowest good rung is still the school teacher, and after him comes what? The daughter of an Am Haaretz. And I specifically left this with three dots because I didn't want to read the continuation. The line... You want to hear the next part of it? Yeah. You're dying to hear it.
Yeah.
Right, after it says, I'll say it in Hebrew and translate. Or ask one of you to translate because I can't get the words out of my mouth. Right. But don't marry the daughter of an Am Haaretz, Sheheim Sheretz, Unishotehem Sheketz, Ve'al Bnotehem Hu Omer Arur Shochev Imkol Behema. Because they don't marry the daughter of one of these people, because they are vermin and their wives are, I don't know how to translate it, and one who sleeps with their daughters, it's of them it is written, cursed is he who sleeps with any animal, right? Now this, of course, is Am Haaretz. This is not the school teacher, but of course, what is the point, right? They're telling you, if you become an Haaretz, this is what we're going to say behind your back, right, about you. Better go to the school teacher, right, and do it. Now, as a result, something very interesting happened. Where was the schoolhouse? Where was it? And this is interesting. In the Babylonian Talmud, very often, the school teacher would set up shop in his backyard. And we have a whole discussion in the Babylonian Talmud in Tractate Bava Batra, page 21a. There's a whole discussion there. What happens if neighbors complain? Now, you realize what the problem is. Neighbors can complain about noise. But my gosh, what is he teaching? He's teaching Torah. And you see this tension in the Talmudic discussion. On the one hand, they deserve to be able to sleep and to think, right? But the kids are making noise. Can you complain? Can't you complain? The rabbis of Palestine solved it very simply. If it is the community that is paying the salary, why not put the school in a communal building? What is the best communal building? The synagogue, the Beit Knesset. And so we have stories that in the Palestinian Talmud, it would be in public. In the public arena, it would be in a pub. And here, I think I put this source in. Yeah, go to the first page. Source number 8. Now, again, this is a perfect example of how the rabbis are not historians. They deal with law, with halakha. But through the back door, you get a bit of history. There is a halakha, there is a law that says the following. You cannot take a shortcut. Well, it begins with the through a sacred territory, meaning you were not allowed to use the Temple Mount in Jerusalem to go from point A to point B in Jerusalem by taking shortcuts through the Mikdash. Why? Because that's sacred territory. And the same is true, the word is kapandria, kapandaria in Greek. The same is true regarding a synagogue. You cannot go through a synagogue to shorten the path to get where you're going. That's off limits. It's a sacred area. Now, and by the way, those of you who have ever been, I don't know, here it doesn't really relate, but in Jerusalem, there are a lot of shuls in Jerusalem. Those, Yeshurun, do you remember Yeshurun? For years, if you wanted to go from Karen, perfect, right, he's an old Jerusalemite. If you wanted to go from the Ratisbon Monastery, I don't know what you're doing in the Ratisbon Monastery, but if you happen to be there and wanted to get to the post office on Keren Kayemet Street, the best way of doing it and saving about 10 minutes of walking is going through the back door of Yeshurun Synagogue. You can't do it now because they're building a whole new building there. But until recently, you could go through Yeshurun and save 10 minutes of walking. That's forbidden. Okay. Yeah, I know. Okay. It's a beautiful building, Ratzisbon. So look at source number 8. The courtyard of a synagogue, is it permissible to pass through it as a shortcut? And then we are told, it's not permissible. Rabbi Abahu passed through the courtyard. Is it then permissible? In other words, we saw once Abahu, one of the famous rabbis of Caesarea, taking a shortcut through the courtyard. He wasn't going to pray. He's walking through the courtyard. How could he do it? It's forbidden. Rabbi Zachariah, the son-in-law of Rabbi Levi, said, why? There was an overbearing teacher there. And if Rabbi Abahu had not passed by, he, the teacher, would not have dismissed the children. In other words, why is he walking through the courtyard? He's hinting to the teacher, let them out already. Now, I got to tell you, I found an alternative commentary to this story, which for anyone who ever went like me to PS 180, right, in Brooklyn at one time, and the alternative commentary is that there were some bullies in the courtyard. You know, these were local gangs, you know. And Rabbi Abahu was going near the school to help the kids get out, right, and not be afraid of the of the bullies and to help them through, you know, in other words, for anyone who grew up in certain neighborhoods, I understand that text very, very well, right? And it resonates with me beautifully. In other words, and we have to remember, Caesarea was a mixed town of Jews and non-Jews, of Greeks, and there were all sorts of other types there, right, who were constantly getting into fights with Jews. And so it could be. But what is the point? In Palestine, they do it in the synagogue. Go to page 2. We read, there's an interesting, look at source number 12. Okay, so it's a tax that everybody in the city has to pay. And then they raise an interesting question. What happens if I'm a bachelor? Do I have to pay the school salary tax? Of course. That's why I did it. The bachelor says, why should I pay this tax? I don't have any kids. Rabbis talk about this. Rabbi Tanchuma began his discourse with this text from Job. Who has given me anything beforehand, God says, I shall repay him. In other words, if somebody beats me to the punch and pays me, I will compensate him. This applies to a bachelor who lives in a town and pays wages to teachers of Bible and Mishnah. In other words, the bachelor doesn't complain by saying what? I don't have kids, why should I pay the tax? So he's paying. What do the rabbis say? Of him, the Holy One, blessed is he, God promises, it is for me to pay him his recompense and reward. I'm going to offend half of the people now who are sitting in this room. And what is the wonderful reward? And to give him a male child. You'll forgive me, right? But of course, this is the reality of their thinking of the time. But this is beautiful. In other words, they realize that there will be people in the community who claim, do I have to participate? I'm getting no benefit out of this. Now, this is interesting. I found that the famous Roman historian Pliny says the exact same thing. Even though I don't have any children, I would be willing to pay the salary of teachers, right, or something like that as well. But this is beautiful. In other words, where you see this communal effort. Source number 9 describes how in Palestine, the first centuries, there was a new top official in the Jewish community known as the Nasi, like Judah HaNasi, who edited the Mishnah, the patriarch. And we are told that the patriarch would send messengers to different parts of Palestine to make sure that the school system is functioning. Rabbi Judah Nasiya sent Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Asi and Rabbi Ami to pass through the cities of the land of Israel and establish for them teachers of Bible and Mishnah. They entered one place and found neither a teacher of Bible nor a teacher of Mishnah. So they said to the townsfolk, bring us Now, the phrase is interesting. In English, I wrote, guardians of the city. The phrase is, natore karta. I don't know how many of you know that word, natore karta. Today, when I say natore karta, you all see long payas and whatever, and black hats and whatever it is. The phrase natore karta means the guardians of the city. So here you have these three rabbis coming from Tiberias. They land in a little town, and they say, we want to see the guardians. The people assume they want to see the local constabulary, right? The local police force. So what do? They say, bring us your guardians. They brought before them the local constabulary. And then the sages say, these are the guardians of the town? You think that your safety, your well-being depends on a good police force? We've got news for you. If that's what you believe, they are nothing but the destroyers of the town. Don't ever do this with a police benevolent association. This doesn't work well with them, right? In other words, they are nothing but, if you put your trust only in them, then this town will be destroyed. Why? Then who are the guardians of the town? He replied, these are the teachers of Bible and Mishnah. In other words, teachers are the ones that maintain the town. Yes?
Something occurs to me that goes back to this thing where don't marry an Am Haaretz's daughter.
Yes.
The people that were writing the Mishnah were an educated elite.
Okay.
And maybe all this universal education that we're hearing about wasn't really universal.
Very good. Excellent. Excellent question. In other words, it's the world the way it should be. It's an ideal world and not a practical world. You know what? To a certain degree, I think you're right. The big question is, how much of a degree? And I'll tell you why. Because, and I mentioned this in my first talk here this week, even if you were not a rabbi, but if you went to synagogue and wanted to be called up to Torah, one thing you had to know, how to read words. There's no way you would get that honor otherwise. In other words, my sense is this. The rabbis are portraying an idealized society. But you know what? And by the way, they say this. There's a phrase in Talmud, a very interesting line. 1,000 children enter the school. Out of them, 100 survive to go into the next stage. Out of them, 10 survive to go into the next stage and so on. Their wish is to have a universal system. They know it can't be done. In other words, so in a sense, you're probably right. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. In other words, I have a colleague who actually told me that the same thing was true in Eastern Europe in the early modern period. How many kids do you think really survived more than a few months in the cheder? We have this image that everybody went to cheder and they were there for years and so on. Not that many. And he once told me something. He said that that's really what they wanted. Why? They wanted that most of them should just spend a few months in the cheder to know how difficult it is, so that when they leave, they will have tremendous respect for the survivors, right? Who would ultimately become the rabbis. In other words, boy, this guy made it, right? And you know, the reference that would be for somebody who made it through this. I don't know how accurate that is, but there's some logic to that. So I agree with you. But what is the point here? That you have to set up a system. Now look at a very extreme way of saying this is source number 13. Rabbi Shimon ben, and remember, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai lived during the Bar Kokhba War of 132 to 135. He saw major parts of the land of Israel devastated. And what does he say? If you see towns uprooted from their place in the land of Israel, know that it was because they did not maintain salaries for teachers of Mishnah and Talmud. That's the ultimate punishment. In other words, the community cannot survive without an educational system, meaning salaries for teachers. What is the reason? And they quote a pasuk. I don't want to get into that now. You want to see how modern things are? Look at source number 15. We're almost finished. This is I like this story. Suddenly you realize the famous triangle that we all know today. There are three factors in the teaching process. They are the teachers, the parents, and the Board of Education. Who tells the teachers how they should teach? Who should be telling the teachers how they should teach? When I say Board of Education, I mean, of course, whatever you want to call it, right? In other words, no. You automatically stigmatize them and call them the bureaucracy. Why not look at the Board of Education as the professionals, right? The people who know how it should be done, what's good for the child, and so on. But of course, the parents are convinced we're paying. We know what's really good. Look at this story. The story is based on an interesting bit of information. And that is, when you teach a child how to read, in Jewish tradition, you're teaching him Torah. You may never teach half of a scripture. You should always either recite or read a complete scripture. You never recite a half scripture. Because if God gave you scriptures, full sentences, this is the way it should be preserved. Rabbi Shimon, the teacher of the town of Tarba, not up near Tiberias, was told by the residents of the town, cut the scriptures into portions so that our sons might read. In other words, what do I assume happened? Johnny couldn't read, right? In other words, we have a reality where parents were complaining, we're paying salary, and we're not seeing results. Maybe if you cut up the scriptures and taught them in smaller portions, they'll learn how to read. But the rabbi knows. He's getting instructions not from the parents. Where does he get instructions from? His bosses. His bosses are the big rabbis, often Tiberius. So he went and asked Rabbi Hanina, who told him, and it's a play on words, cutting. Even if they cut your head off, do not listen to them. You don't take orders from the parents. They don't know how to do it. We know how to teach, right? You take orders from us. And so what happened? He did not listen to the parents. And what did they do? They dismissed him. They fired him. End of story, right? In other words, there's nothing special about this story. Because in the end, who can hire or fire the teacher? The parents. So the teachers are between a rock and a hard place. They receive instructions, supposedly, from their mentors. But the parents are the ones paying the salary. Now, the story has an epilogue. And the epilogue is, he comes, so the guy's out without a job, and he goes down to Tiberias, and one of the rabbis said, boy, you're such a righteous person. In the next world, you will be appointed into the great academy in the heaven. And I'm sure that that helped him when he went to the grocery store the next day, right? You know, I'm going to be in the academy in heaven when I die, right? And so on. In other words, you have this sense of who's running it. So you have the sense nothing has ever changed. If you want to really sense how nothing has ever changed, this is where I'll end off this talk. The next source, 16, I left dangling it. I have to explain this, and then it's beautiful. The Mishnah says, one may not read by the light of a lamp. This on Shabbat, what is the problem? Well, when they say lamp, you know what they mean. Like an Aladdin's lamp. You know what a lamp looked like in antiquity? It was like a dish, and you had oil in the dish, and you had the wick coming out on the side, and the wick draws, there's like a spout, right, and the wick is coming out of the spout. The wick draws the oil from the lamp, and as long as there's enough oil in the lamp, it's burning. The Mishnah says you cannot use a lamp like this on Shabbat to read. Why? Because what is the fear? When the oil begins to to be used up, the wick will not draw the oil constantly, and the light will begin to flicker. Now, what will you do almost automatically? You want to bring more oil to the wick. So what do? You will tip over the lamp so that the oil that's still there will be concentrated and come to the wick. The problem is you are causing a fire to continue to be burnt, and burning fire on Shabbat is considered forbidden. So the Mishnah says, in matters of fire, don't read by candlelight, because you may inadvertently, right, tip the candle over on Shabbat. But there's an exception. The chazan, and here it means one of the official, it's not the cantor. When they use the word chazan, they don't mean the way we use it today as chazan, right, cantor. They mean one of the officials in the school who was also a school teacher. The chazan may see where the children read, but he himself may not read. This is the exception. On Friday night, the children would have to prepare the weekly parsha in the synagogue in front of the chazan, and they are permitted to read by candlelight. They are the one exception. To which the Talmud asks, why are they an exception? And you have two answers, one in the Babylonian Talmud and one in the Palestinian Talmud. And you'll see why I love the Palestinian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud says, why are they a legitimate exception? The phrase in Hebrew is emat rabam aleihem. They are not suspected of tampering with the candle, because who are they afraid of? Their teacher. They know you're not allowed to touch the candle. If you do, Rabbi will smack you, right? So they are so afraid of their Rebbe that they won't approach the candle. Palestinian Talmud gives a 10 times better answer. We don't suspect them of tampering with the candle for one simple reason. They want the light to go out. These are kids, right? Right? And so, nothing has changed in 1800 years. But I think that we can learn something from all of these sources. And that is the sense of immediacy that they felt in dealing with education. And you see, and I just chose a few of the sources here, this sense of, and when we spoke about obsession with books and education, this is what I meant. They're thinking into the finest details of how to maintain a system. And this idea of communal education, of the community supporting the education system, which was unique in the annals of antiquity, I think is something that we draw on to this very day. I'll end off, since you're all patrons here, as Ari has told me, with another. As I was preparing this talk here, I came across another little story, and I thought it was meaningful for this type of a group. And this is a Hasid. I found it, by the way, in a book written by Agnon. Agnon has a book. When I was preparing my talk on books, Agnon once wrote a book that is not well known in many circles. And the name of the book is Sefer Sofrim Sipurim, Books, Authors, and Stories. And he gives you sort of an anthology of stories about books and of learning and so on. And he tells the story of a father who approaches a Hasidic Rebbe and he says, I want you to bless my son that he should study Torah. And the Rebbe says, I can't do it. It won't work. If I bless him, the best you can hope for is that what? When he becomes a father, he'll come to me saying, I want you to bless my son that he studies Torah. Yeah. You want him to study Torah? There's only one thing. You have to study. He's got to see you as a model. That is the only assurance that you have that a child will study. And so I say that to groups of adults that study. I think the advantage of this is not only that we're doing this to learn, we're doing this